Season 5 of the Telly Award-winning podcasts on the floors of Tokyo O or down in London Town to Go-Go. With a record selection and a mirror's reflection, we are dancing with ourselves today. Wow. There you go.
You went deep there.
Little William Idol. Yeah. And I will close this out by going sweat. little fist pumping today. The fist pumper on your screen right now, in your ear like a can of beer, is Rylan Grant, screenwriter, Ringo Award-winning creator of fine comics like Aberrant, Banjax, and The Jump, and a tremendous Billy Idol fan. I think he's very underrated. The other voice in the dark, the man with the beautiful mustache to my left, if you're watching, is...
David Avalone, writer of comic books and television things, and it's a nice day for a white wedding.
Ooh, there we go. That's a good track.
Start again.
Love it. If you missed any of our previous conversations, episodes featuring comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Rodney Barnes, and many, many more, we have never had Billy Idol on, but we should change that. Our entire catalog could be celebrated via YouTube, Apple Pods, other purveyors of worthwhile ear cracks, so double on back and check it all out. Great show today. We have some Hall of Famers on with us, which is always great and wonderful as my dog scratches at the door trying to get in. We should, before we bring them on, get rid of some house cleaning. So what do you have for us? What do you have coming out, Avalone?
Currently on stands, as they say. I have Drawing Blood number 2. There's your Eastman cover and your Troy Little. Speaking of 80s rockers, your Troy Little Queen variant.
Love it.
Cover a little Radio Gaga.
It's there. Really good.
Little Bohemian Rhapsody, and Elvira meets H.P. Lovecraft 5 will be out before the end of the month, as will Drawing Blood number 3.
Yeah, that's yeah, the Queen homage cover is a strong move. It is not something that I have thought of or would have thought of. It's a brilliant thing, but it is the kind of move I would make where
it is actually not a random out of left field thing. A plot thread in the comic is the main character is doing a musical adaptation of the silent film Metropolis, which was used in the Queen music video for Radio Gaga. So it's all a web of connections and ridiculousness.
It's all
connected. What do you got going on?
State of Consciousness is still in a couple of theaters available on streaming, though I don't know that I effusively recommend you go watch it. What I do effusively recommend you go watch is Haunted Heart, which will be out later this summer, starring Matt Dillon from director Fernando Treva. So that's going on.
Nice.
New Kickstarter brewing soon. I'm trying to actually settle on which title to release. I got 3 possibilities, and so I am still working that. Luckily, today's show is Kickstarter centered, and we have 3 very brilliant Kickstarterers on, and maybe they can help me sort through some of it. But why don't we bring them on and stop talking?
Sure, ladies and gentle folk, Stephen Prince.
Woo! Woo!
Okay, this is a lot to tell you.
Oh, yeah! Woo!
Hi.
No, that's it.
I just think the irony of doing a Billy Idol opening when this show can usually opens with such a conformist yell.
I will say that I actually hold the honor of directing Billy Idol
in his
first animated experience as Madman Mulligan in the Horrible Histories show episode, The Magnificent Mounties. If you look it up, I spent an afternoon with him, and yes, he did his rebel yell several times. Did not make it into the cut, but it was fun to...
Was the rebel yell scripted, or was it an unscripted, spontaneous rebel yell?
It was more prompted by the other voice actors who wanted to hear Billy Idol be more Billy Idol, as he was trying to figure out how to be a voice actor so he could do some work that his kids could see. You know, I think that's a tradition a lot of us end there at some point in our lives. We're like, we want our kids to see our work.
The day went late. We were getting towards the midnight hour, and you were just like, Billy,
more.
Well, he shouldn't let his children see the Rock the Cradle of Love music video, probably. Certainly not any teenage daughters. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Just quick, what you got going on right now. Stephen Prince, let's start with you.
I'm the creator and writer of Monster Matador, and we currently have a Kickstarter going on for our epic Once Upon Some Monsters in Mexico, number 1 through 3 on Kickstarter till June 18th. Other than that, I used to make toys, write comics, and that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Nice. And Charlie?
I'm Charlie Stickney, publisher of White Ash Comics that does titles like White Ash, The Game, Glarian. Currently, we have a Kickstarter live for How I Slept My Way Through College and Other Tales from Freshman Year 1 through 3, about a young freshman journalism student who uncovers the scoop of a lifetime that one of her professors is running a high-end escort service using some of the students as call girls.
This is not related to the White Ash universe.
It's autobiography.
Oh, sorry.
Tangentially. there is a comic book shop in this series, and they seemingly only stock books from White Ash and other Kickstarter titles.
Sure. Sure, that makes sense. And Richard, how about you?
I'm Richard Fairgray. I'm the writer and artist behind the Richard Sucks line, grown-up comics for dirtbags, gays, and ladies. Titles like Wet Cement, Octopus, Haunted Hill, and my current Kickstarter for the Ex-Wives of Frankenstein, issues 1 through 3, which is the story of Elizabeth Frankenstein and the Bride of the Monster on the day they find out their husbands are alive, living as a gay couple in the Arctic, and returning to the city as heroes of Reddit, Twitter, and the MRA movement.
Very nice.
Yeah, rock and roll.
I like that we as a society have decided to not accept Elon Musk changing the name of Twitter. I think that's a positive thing. Like, it doesn't really seem like there's anyone in the mainstream that will willingly call it X. Which I think is excellent. Yeah. That said, we are, a lot of us are still using it for promotion. Twitter, that is. Yeah. And that does link us to where we're going today, which is talking about Kickstarter and what is the state of the union. Everyone here has done one. Everyone here has done one that did pretty well. And I'm hearing that the landscape is changing out there and not necessarily for the better. Richard, why don't you start us off? What are your impressions of the current landscape?
I think everyone feels like it's on the verge of chaos, but no one's sure exactly why or how. Mm. You know, we're hearing all of these rumblings about the not safe for work stuff being shadow banned. We're hearing stories about people's campaigns just suddenly not doing well after long-running success. We're seeing incredibly erratic campaigns with incredible first days and then nothing for weeks. So it seems like either the absolute maximum number of people who will ever use Kickstarter have shown up and no one new is there, or everything's fine and we just have to wait it out. And I really hope it's the latter.
That's interesting. And how have your own projects been faring compared to the past?
Honestly, I'm this anomaly on Kickstarter where I do exactly the same every time. Mm-hmm. I have had zero growth across a year and a half. I get fantastic results. Like, I think on my current campaign, I have 2 new backers.
Ooh, well.
Which is actually unusual even for me. But I also have this incredibly high retention rate of like I have something like 60 people who have backed all 8 of my campaigns.
Wow.
So I can't really speak to it in terms of like how it seems to work. Every piece of advice I ever get from anyone says the exact opposite of what happens to me.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that that rings true of any generalization. There's always going to be an outlier. It does, I will say, it does sound like you have a very high customer satisfaction rate, and that is a pretty good thing in comics if you have a core group. My second big campaign with Eastman, we had, I want to say, like 300 or 400 fewer backers and made more money. So, you know, again, conventional wisdom, not always a thing you can follow. And I think with Kickstarter, you do get the thing of sometimes people who back your first one think, oh, he doesn't need me anymore. I don't have to keep backing these. And that's when the friends and family backers drop out and it's actual customers that you're dealing with.
Oh, see, this was my big life hack. I spent about 38 years alienating friends and family, so I had almost none of them on my first campaign.
Yeah. No, that definitely gives you a more accurate picture.
It's a good way to go.
Of what the public... Yeah. No, I mean, when I used to co-produce live shows and things like that, I remember someone saying to me, you don't know the show is a success until you look out of the curtains and you don't see anyone in the audience that you recognize. That's when you know you're actually, like, marketing, advertising, and word of mouth is working. Is when you have a full theater and it's not. There's no one in there who's doing a pal a favor. Charlie, how's it going for you these days?
You know, I'm fortunate that I have a large enough brand that I think in times of slowdown, economic slowdown, that's what people gravitate towards. The things that they know. And I think that's something that's happening overall in a lot of different spaces, not just the comic space, the market. Everyone is going to the bigger brands because, you know, it's like the blue chip stocks that, you know, like it used to be forever, like you could always go IBM and Sears, right? I mean, I guess those are two terrible examples of things that you could stock in forever. But, you know, like I guess like whatever those stocks are, those blue chip stocks, right? And I think we are in a little bit of a time of uncertainty politically. You know, there are, even though the economy is doing okay, I think people have this sense of they're not sure if it's going to keep doing okay, so they don't want to spend their money. The entertainment industry as a whole is going through crazy flux right now, so people don't know where their money is going to come from as a writer. There's more writers who worked in the entertainment industry who are looking to go do other things right now than I think there have been in the 25 years that I've been doing this. You know, and so like with all that turnover and change, I think you have a lot of people looking to try out Kickstarter. So that's bringing in a whole bunch of new projects right now that might not have the foresight to have spent time really trying to build a brand first and are just kind of launching in. But there are projects that are doing crazy well on Kickstarter right now. Like the G.I. Joe project is probably going to be the biggest comic book project ever on Kickstarter. It's going to beat Neil Gaiman's Good Omens, which was, I don't know, 6 months ago, which at that point was the biggest comic book project on Kickstarter ever. So you have...
Did that out-earn the Berserker?
Oh, yeah. Neil Gaiman was like... It was like 3.5 million or something. So it was a good over a million more. And this G.I. Joe comic book is going to blow both of those away. But again, it comes down to like those blue chip stocks, things that people know that they're willing to spend their money on because they know what they're getting. And Kickstarter always has a little bit of that uncertainty. So I think people are pulling back, which is why Richard's probably doing really well, because his people know exactly what they're going to get. And it's all good stuff, but it's very much Richard, right? And, you know, like... I would say like my numbers are exactly the same on this campaign in terms of number of backers. But a lot of these people are going digital where they might have gone physical before. So they want the story, they want the thing. So like the financial numbers are down, but the backer numbers are still there.
It is such a weird thing because, you know, it is, I mean, entertainment in general is in flux and I guess just chaos, you know, people kind of freak out and they're more careful and everything. However, there is nothing to watch right now, you know? I mean, my wife and I, that was what we used to do. It's like, well, you know, we get the kid to bed and go to the TV and we have a list of 10 things that we're excited to get to. And some of them we don't get to because there's too much. And that's not the case anymore. It is, we go to the TV. It's like, oh, there's nothing again. I'm going to go wash dishes and listen to a Ringer podcast. And she's going to watch some, you know, fit a reality TV. She probably wouldn't have watched if there was a good drama on. And so that is weird. It seems like there should be a thirst. It seems like people should be out looking for stuff. You know, it seems like they should be trolling, for stories. And yeah, it hasn't quite happened yet, you know, and maybe that is just because, again, it's like, you know, people, you know, there's a storm, right? And they're staying inside until they understand how bad the storm is. And then maybe they'll step out into the rain, you know, when they're confident that things are going to be okay. But yeah, it's a little weird. It's a little unnerving. I mean, the other thing that I'm doing is, you know, this, you know, the Neil Gaiman campaign, like, I ask the question almost every show, what does a traditional publisher have to offer anyone right now? And of course there are things. However, if you are Neil and you can go to Kickstarter and earn $3 million for your book rather than getting paid a page rate or and having a percentage or whatever, like, why in God's name? I mean, I think publishers are so fucked right now. And we're already seeing it. I mean, we've lost what, half of them already. It's crazy what's happening, you know, and I guess we saw it happen in music, you know, when everybody could record an album in their, you know, in their spare bedroom on a laptop and then release it on their own via iTunes or fucking Bandcamp or whatever. That didn't obliterate the music industry, but it changed irrevocably, right? I mean, like those, you know, there used to be five companies and you had to get permission from them to make your album. And if you didn't, then, you know, whatever, you were, you played weddings, you know? That's not the case anymore. And yeah, I don't know. It's like, we'll always have something, but it's like, this isn't getting better for them. You know, it's going to get much worse, and that's good for us in a way, but not in another way. It's not great for comic shops. It's not great for, you know, the music business didn't fight tooth and nail to like keep the status quo. We are attempting to do that.
I was going to say, just like when you take the music industry, look at record stores.
Yeah.
Or the lack thereof.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's unfortunately, if we're looking at what's happening, you have the high-end people, you know, your Neil Gaimans, who don't need to go to a publisher. Yeah. And you have the up-and-coming artists who shouldn't go to one. So just have that middle ground, and I don't know if there's enough there to support publishers and the comic book industry.
Mentioning, though, the G.I. Joe project that you were talking about, that's a publisher. That's not some scrappy kid in the basement. That's a major license that is beloved, that is a nostalgia project, and that is making a ton of money. And look at, you know, my publisher Dynamite is making a ton of money off of nostalgia projects, off of Disney villains and Darkwing Duck and Gargoyles, and like apparently 80s kids can be Gen X has just enough disposable income to keep these things going. But I want to hear Steve's perspective on where we are and how yours are going.
Yeah, I agree with everything Charlie said, Richard said. You know, I mean, my campaigns have been steady. Right now we're running a campaign. We're following the same pattern as our last campaign. I've definitely seen more of a shift to digital. One thing, you know, for my campaigns, I always look at like kind of, you know, spending patterns and things like that. And I have a lot of readers. You're not into like collectibles and things like that. So I focus on that. But I think part of the challenges, you know, some campaigns are having or that I see is that also I'm lucky that this is my eighth campaign. So I built a core audience, you know, you kind of know that you're going to get your book, you're going to get your story. But I think a lot of times and what I see is that a lot of creators look to other campaigns without really digging in and understand why they're doing the numbers they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, a campaign can have 200 backers and do $10,000, but the average campaign with 2000 backers with a new book will probably do $5,000, you know, and there are reasons for that. You know, Charlie can get 10 or 15 from 200 backers because he has that longevity and he has that backlist and whatnot. So I think a lot of the struggles are also kind of like not reading the room, but also pricing. You see a lot of single issue books at $20 plus $5 shipping, you know? And again, there's a lot of costs involved in making this stuff and you got to make that money back. So it's part of it is finding that right balance. The other thing I think that is, you know, sometimes running too many campaigns, depending on what your audience is, might work against you. But the reality is that campaigns like G.I. Joe are very positive for the platform because they're bringing in thousands of new backers who, you know, like I said, one of the hardest things is to get someone to sign up for Kickstarter. The challenge while running a campaign, especially a new campaign, during a campaign that big, because that's like almost a $400 buy-in, you know, is that it's going to suck a lot of the air in the room. So people who might have backed your campaign but are doing, you know, the $400 buy-in on G.I. Joe are probably going to have to make some choices about what they can back during that time. But if you play the long game, right, your next campaign is going to benefit from that because those people are now in the ecosystem. Yeah. So it's really, you know, Kickstarter is always going to have these, you know, ups and downs. And as a creator, someone who's running those, you really need to dig into those patterns and those numbers and really try to figure out how your campaign or how your property exists within that ecosystem. I don't do an NSFW books. You know, those books are a whole different level. So if you're doing a book like Monster Matador and you're comparing that to an NSFW book, there's going to be a big gap between, you know, your potential in terms of how people are backing it, you know, because you're not running NSFW covers and things like that, which bring in extra dollars into campaigns. So a lot of it is data. A lot of it is just kind of like reading the room. But I think Kickstarter, you know, like everything, is coming out of the pandemic, which was really huge for a lot of people. And spending patterns are changing, you know, because people are going out again. And, you know, like Charlie said, like Rylan said, comfort food right now is a really big thing. You know, these campaigns like G.I. Joe, Terminator, whatnot, people are definitely going back to those types of properties.
I would really push back on the NSFW thing, though, because, like, the NSFW books that do well get a lot of attention for being sexy. They get, and a lot of people, like, they're divisive. People are either horrified that porn exists because, you know, they don't.
Sure, but it's an audience that isn't served in the mainstream market.
Right, right, so, my point is that those books don't actually, like, if you look at the actual full scope of what is available on the platform, they do about just as well as everything else.
Oh, I'm not saying as a scope, but there are, you know, you see some of those books blow up, and I think people tend to, you know, people tend to see the big successes as opposed to looking at the bigger picture.
Yeah, those books. That's what I mean. Yeah, there are several of those books that make way too much money. Where it's like, I'm going to take this, you know, there's no real idea. It's like I took Snow White with boobs or whatever. You know what I'm saying? And I'm not saying there aren't good ones. You know what I'm saying? Because there are, but a lot of that is trite. You know.
But those books, 1,000 of those books don't do well.
But you have screenwriters like, you know, no, I'm kidding. But you have people who are looking at those campaigns and go, oh, I'm going to run a Kickstarter because this campaign did 15K. They're not looking at the average campaign that says, oh, okay, it's going to do 4 to 5K, you know, which is a great number.
There are ones that do poorly. However, I remember on my last campaign, which was just a couple of months ago. And I remember looking at the you know, again, like you're looking to see who you're going to contact for cross promotion. And I don't judge anybody that runs a not safe for work campaign. I don't want to cross promote with one of those campaigns for the most part. Every once in a while, there's one that's great. But it's like there's just a lot of garbage. And I remember sorting all of the active campaigns by most backed. And I would say like 26 of the top, like, 35 to 40 campaigns were not safe for work books, that most of which were complete garbage. And that was troubling to me. So like there's something to it. I agree with Richard that like there's a lot that fails. However, those books do way too well for what the substance is.
I think that if we really want to dig down into what is on Kickstarter or what is in the direct market, I think we can all agree, like we can all agree that we feel like most books do better than they deserve to do. Like, and I'm not like,
no, I don't.
I'm sorry. I look at, I look through Kickstarter.
Name names. Yeah.
Stephen. Yeah. I was going to name all three of you. And then I was like, it's funny. If I just no, look, like I look through Kickstarter a lot. I back a lot of books on Kickstarter, and quite frankly, if I get drunk and impulse buy a G.I. Joe book, which I'm not going to do because I don't like G.I. Joe, but like, let me use a real example. If I get drunk and impulse buy a fucking Daria toy for $150, like in 9 months' time, that thing's going to arrive, and I'm going to be excited because I've had 9 months to think about the cool thing I'm going to get. If I back a thing on a whim on Kickstarter and 9 months later I receive a single issue that I've forgotten about, 9 times out of 10, I am disappointed by the thing that I read. Because that's not a Kickstarter problem. That's not an indie comics problem. That is the reality of the world. It's the same feeling I have when I buy comics in a comic store from a major publisher. Most stuff is not nearly as good as I hope it's going to be. The stuff that I'm seeing, my larger point here before I get crucified for saying that things are bad, is that this comes down to taste. I don't like the stuff most of you probably like. You don't like the stuff I like. None of us like the same stuff as each other. And the boob coming out of her shoulder Western porn comic, I'm sure does very well. And the people who buy it are fucking thrilled to get it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's the thing. Like, I would push back a little bit on the, like, doing better than they deserve to do. It's like, that's the world, man. Like, I would like to live in a world where there were no McDonald's, but that would make billions of people really unhappy. Yeah. Like I said, it's not my job to say you should all be eating better food. I don't care. Eat whatever the hell you want, and if you want to eat crap, good for you. That's fantastic, and I'm happy for you. You know, I don't. You know, so I don't know that there's such a thing as like. I do feel though, and this is a larger issue of. I was actually thinking about this just this week because I bought some new first issues in the last couple of weeks and did not see a lot of good work that I was impressed by. And it occurred to me that, of course, an industry that doesn't pay very well often attracts people who just want to do the thing, whether they're good at it or not, or whether they could get hired by someone else to do it or not. And you end up with an interesting talent pool. There are a lot of amazing and talented people making comics, but there are also a lot of people who just, this is what they can do. And you look at the art and you look at the writing and you go, this isn't very good.
Sorry, sorry, guys.
It's not. Your stuff is great, Stephen.
But I think this is a really good point. And I'll just want to say one quick thing on the not safe for work. One of the reasons why I think some of those books do really well is the cover market has cooled on Kickstarter. And that used to be a way of upping your per unit price. Except for Not Safe for Work covers, because a lot of people like to get different shades of naked people. You know, if you're going to get one naked person, you might want to get a bunch of naked people. So, while I'm not saying that one of those reasons that Not Safe for Work projects, I actually think they have a higher per pledge rate than some other projects, because if someone is backing that project, they might be more inclined to get multiple covers. But I think the larger issue, and this is, you know, where you see a lot of people complaining about Kickstarter, and honestly, a lot of these people are, I don't want to say smaller creators, but they're creators without as large of a fan base, is I think the bar over the last 4 to 5 years has gone dramatically up of what is a good quality project on Kickstarter. And this is where publishers coming into Kickstarter actually might hurt the indie creator, because the perception of what is a professional book that's being put out on Kickstarter has changed. So your indie book that was about a superhero that did okay 3 to 4 years ago now isn't doing the same numbers. And that might be because the overall backer pool has changed, expectations have changed, and people are looking for something better on Kickstarter, where it used to be a little bit more of the Wild West. If you're just getting your first book out there, you could put it out there. And if the art wasn't up to par, that was okay because people wanted to support indie creators. And so I think that's really affecting a lot of people's perception because they're not doing as well, but they have to look internally and say, hey, I need to get better at what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the reasons we thought this would be a good conversation is, of course, I'm hearing whispers and hearing people complain about how things are going on Kickstarter. And I think the flaw in our design for this show is we invited on three guests who have done incredibly well building very specific brands that people like and back. So but, you guys are suffering to the same degree that I think a lot of other creators are suffering out there.
Yeah, but again, the point is, and that's a very important point, is building a brand that people like. And I think a lot of people are going onto the platform, putting their book on there and it just expecting people to come. Yeah. But, you know, and you have, again, you have to be realistic. If you're throwing a superhero book on there, you're competing with Marvel, DC, and about 500 other books that come out in the comic book store a month. So you're going to have a much harder climb and a much harder time unless you're offering something that's different. And I think when you look at Charlie's books, when you look at my book or whatever, or books that are successful, they tend to have something that is not necessarily found in, you know, in great quantity in the direct market, you know? But again, it's expectation. When people, when I see a lot of people say they're doing bad, I look at what's your expectation? What is your campaign doing? What's your campaign expectation now as opposed to what it was your last campaign? If your last campaign did 5K, and your new campaign, you're expecting to raise 7,500 and you're not quite hitting that number. You're having a struggle to get to that number. It's not Kickstarter. It's the expectation, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so there is a lot of that involved. And again, like Kickstarter is an ecosystem. It's a platform. And it's one as a creator that you really need to take the time to understand. And data is so important, you know, and like Charlie said, with covers, NSFW covers, people are more likely to get multiple covers. If you're backing Monster Matador, you're likely to get one cover, right? So there's, you know, there's a lot of variables involved in terms of why campaigns do what they do and why some campaigns struggle and why they don't. But expectation, I think, is a big part of that.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people go into it with the idea that it's easy money. Regardless of what fan base they have, you know, I mean, it's a shitty 21st century question. But when someone tells me they want to go into, you know, crowdfunding, I'm like, how many followers do you have on Twitter? How many friends do you have on Facebook? And, you know, what's your reach? Because someone's actually got to know it's out there. You can't just hope that it gets in the Kickstarter newsletter.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, reach is really important, but it's also branding where you are known. There was a creator who I had never heard of before. He's a creator who does a lot of stuff in the direct market. He just recently dropped a book on Kickstarter. And going back to what Steven was saying about expectations, he was asking for 40K for his book. And it was like a 40-page book that he's trying to raise $40,000 for. And he's on Kickstarter. And it's the first time he's been on the platform. And like, I, you know, I was in a Discord where people were like, I can't believe this guy is never, you know, is having trouble funding. And I'm like, I've never heard of this guy. Yeah, you're like, right. I don't know who he is. And just because you have some direct market success does not mean you have Kickstarter success or a Kickstarter brand. And that's the important thing to know is like, there are, like, I can walk into comic book shops and no one who has any idea who I am. But if I'm in the Kickstarter space, people know where, you know, what my books are. I'm a brand on Kickstarter. I'm not a brand in, you know, in digital comics. Like, you have to know where you're known and sort of double down on that, build a brand there. And you can't just walk in unless you're Neil Gaiman, where everyone knows your brand.
Well, but, and like, I think it does depend on what Carrie Fisher calls your middle name. If you've got a lot of direct market books, but it's, you know, Ant-Man and, you know, Zatanna, that's very different from your middle name being Spider-Man or Superman.
I'm not 100% sure it is. Like, I mean, like, it is to a degree, but I don't think as much as you might think. Like, there are so many people who, and this is even pre-Kickstarter, people would talk about how if only I could get a job writing Batman, then I would have like all the people would come and buy my indie book. And it has never actually worked.
Yeah, no, that's no, the, I, no I'm talking about it. When it's relevant, though.
But the problem is, if you do something like Ant-Man and you get a big following, or if you do something like what was the fucking 9 panels on every page, very well designed book that I'm.
The Tom King book or
Watchmen? Tom King book, yeah. Like you do something like that with a lesser known character, people actually get to know who you are as the creator. Yeah. Work on Superman, everyone only remembers, like, you get overshadowed. Yeah. It's the same thing
it depends on what your run is with that. I'm saying more sure. that. What I'm saying is, that was an oversimplified way of saying it depends on what you did in the direct market. If what you did, the reason I used Ant-Man as an example is if you wrote an Ant-Man book that nobody read, the name Ant-Man as your middle name is not necessarily going to do anything for you. If you read a Superman book, if you wrote a Superman book, it has more likelihood that someone read it and that maybe it did well and that maybe it, you know, translates if you're doing a Superman book. I know this just because I've seen people come into Kickstarter from Marvel or DC, and the bigger the character name they were able to sell themselves as, you know, when someone could put Spider-Man and Daredevil in their name, I saw those books do well despite maybe the quality of the book being up to what it
should. But the other thing is there's a lot of people on Kickstarter who don't buy things from the direct market. Right. So like your name in the direct market might not mean anything to them. That's more what I mean. It's like you need to build a name in this marketplace too.
A Connor Hughes cover is going to have a lot of weight on Kickstarter, as opposed to a lot of direct market guys. You know,
specifically, I can put that in my campaign, and I can say, hey, people who are fans of Connor, go to this campaign. And you can pick up this cover too. So we can direct Connor fans to another campaign. Whereas, it's very hard for someone who's coming from the direct market to say to all their fans, come to Kickstarter, because that's not how they usually buy books.
Right.
I also think it's not like having the name or having a middle name that is reasonable and has some oomph. It is not a direct line to success. It gets them in it gets them in the store. You know what I'm saying? It was like, when I came to Kickstarter, if I would have came to Kickstarter from left field, then my floor would have been much lower. But because I had put some books in comic shops, and because I had an award and could put some directors' names in my bio, that raised my floor to a degree. But really all it does is there's so much on Kickstarter and more and more every day. It just got people to stop. It just got people to stop and look. Right. Yeah. And so that's half the battle, is getting people to stop and look. You know, again, we've all been an artist's alley, and everybody wants to walk by your table. Right. And so how do you get them to stop and look at what's on the table? Right. That is job one. And so I think the middle name gets them to stop and look at what's on the proverbial table. Then it has to be good. Then it has to be interesting. It has to be their bag. It has to be all these things. And so that is two things that have to come together in order to make a sale and in order
I said this a million times, but it's like with drawing blood, it really doesn't matter a lot. It gets some eyes on us that it's Kevin Eastman from the Ninja Turtles, but the book is so not that thing that it's not, someone who's like, I like to see funny animals fighting crime. And it's like, well, here's a middle-aged alcoholic writer struggling with his demons. You want to see that, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, but does he fight a giant robot at any point? No, he really, there are no giant robots.
I'd also argue, Ryland, we came in at the same time, which was right as the pandemic hit. I think had you come in now on Kickstarter, you'd probably have, I think you'd have successful campaigns. I don't know if it would be as big as what you know what I mean? Just because the landscape has changed, what we're talking about. So it's definitely a lot harder.
No, that was a maximum growth time for.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was definitely.
What Steven's saying is we should really hope for another pandemic.
Yeah.
I really want to sit at home with my kids.
I was actually surprised when I ran the second Peacekeepers campaign. That was the last thing. Yeah. And Peacekeepers is not Kickstarter NIP, right? It's a Fargo-esque crime drama, thinking man's police procedural, which is not, you think of Kickstarter and you think of, fantasy and sci-fi and boobs and whatever else. I came on with The Jump. And I've run three Jump campaigns, and those are easy to run. People want that. And Jump is also a little bit sexy, and there's intrigue, and so it does well. It does easy. The first Kickstarter campaign was like pulling teeth. Like I made the same amount of money and had similar backer numbers as I did for my Jump campaigns, but I had to work twice as hard to get them. It was every day I woke up, I didn't have the backers I needed, and I needed to go and knock on doors and tap on shoulders and all that stuff. I was worried about running the second Peacekeepers campaign, particularly in this climate, because everybody's telling me how hard it was. And I was actually like, I don't know what the explanation was for it, but it was like running a Jump campaign this time. It was like I didn't improve. But again, like Steve said, I had the correct expectations, and I was hoping my swing for the fence was, oh, well, let me equal these other campaigns. And yeah. I did so, a lot more easily than I thought I was going to. It was not a lot of work.
Yeah. You've also had 4 years to build your brand, and that's a big part of it. You know?
Sure. But I had taken about 2 years off also.
So
Maybe people were just like, it's like, oh, Ryland's back and we're not tired of him anymore.
Yeah. The middle name thing. This is the first and last name thing. Like if your name was, John Smith, it's not as memorable as Ryland Grant.
There you go.
Ringo Award winner Ryland Grant campaigns often start.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Shots fired.
I think you're it's the thing you said, you got to get people to look at your table.
Yeah.
I think a lot of this is very analogous to teaching. If you're a really good teacher, you can get your kids to move forward at a faster rate than other teachers. If you're a really bad teacher, the kids will probably do fine. Like every study shows that kids just tend to progress at a certain speed as long as the stuff is put in front of them. And I think that we all have this idea that whatever we do on Kickstarter, the results we see are a result, are consequences of our actions. And I think more and more, as people just know that stuff is there, as people just get the one email or the Kickstarter update reminder at the last minute, whatever, like as we just get these people who happen to be on Kickstarter backing us, the reason we get the same number of people on the next campaign as we did on the last is probably about 90% to do with just those like actually taking actions doesn't seem to make that much of a difference a lot of the time. But yeah. I think that, if I post an update and I get three new backers, I have no way of knowing if I would have gotten those three new backers by doing nothing.
No, you're the best you can do is correlation. You can never do causation. Yeah. You can never, you can hope the best when this show drops on Wednesday, we'll see if anybody's backer numbers go up that afternoon or the next, 48 hours. But even that, it's just correlation. It's not causation. Yeah. And there's no way to really quantify it.
Yeah. There's something almost satisfying when something that should make a difference gets you zero backers for the next 24 hours after it comes out, because then you can definitively say, I don't need to care about that thing anymore.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. My wife used to produce a live show in LA and spent a lot of time and energy flyering the town and putting flyers in, vintage clothing stores and record stores, the few that exist and all that. And I said to her once, we spent a lot of time and energy doing this. Can you put a coupon code on them for $1 off at the door? Because I want to see if this is worth it at all. And no one brought the flyers back. Attendance at shows. And I said, you can now safely not do this.
Yeah.
Whoever is coming to the shows, they're not coming to the show with the flyer in their hand. So that means the flyering ultimately didn't move the needle. Like this is a coupon. We gave people a coupon for the door and it didn't show up. So
they're
therefore stop doing it. You know,
it was the biggest thing. Yeah. The biggest thing for me was figuring out, cause this can become a full-time job. You can literally work morning, noon and night trying to promote this thing, trying to move the needle and figuring out what is worth your time and what isn't. It was a big deal. And it helped to have people like Charlie who could say, yeah, don't do that. That's not worth your time. That's a waste of time. Focus on this instead. It's like, really? Yeah. That works.
You can, I mean, like one of the nice things about Kickstarter is like your coupon code, you can create referral links.
Yeah.
So you can actually track exactly where your traffic is coming from and which efforts you put out there are bringing the most people in. Yeah. And this is where success begets success. The larger base that you have, the more campaigns that you have, there's more people that you can hit up who have already backed your books. Yeah. So, you know, and that's where you're going to get the most traction. Putting a project update to say, hey, I have this new thing live. Yeah. Is more likely to just doing that, you know, once is going to bring you way more backers than if you're posting on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook every single day for a week. I would guarantee that one post that you do to previous backers will bring in more people because those are the people who like your work, who backed you before, who are predisposed to do what you do. So, I mean, you can find actionable ways to bring people in and find out what works best for your fan base. And then like you were, you know, suggesting, target your energy there to the places that actually work.
Yeah, no, and also, I mean, there are tricks that you have to learn because the algorithm is now built to defeat you. I mean, even back in those days of promoting the burlesque show, like I know I would put up something where there was a link to buy tickets in the post and it would not get me as many clicks as if it was in the first comment because Facebook hides posts with a link in them. Absolutely 100%. It does not want anyone on the platform leaving the platform. Mm-hmm. And even I did a test run during one of my early Kickstarters where I didn't use the word Kickstarter or a link until the first comment. I would literally put out a post that said, I've got a thing going on. It's a new thing. You're going to love it. Look at the first comment. And then the first comment would have the Kickstarter link. Those did like 100% better than a direct, I have a new Kickstarter and here's the link. Because they're clearly being choked intentionally. Mm-hmm. And I would ask people, you know, like chime in if you saw this when I posted about it 3 days ago. And I got back a resounding, no, I didn't see it when it had a link. And we've all seen it. You know, you post something on social media and it gets 3 likes and then you adjust it and it gets 1,000 likes. And you're like, well, that's a thing. That's a thing you've learned. But why don't we start with you? Like, what are things that you think work and what are things you think doesn't work?
Well, and to that point, because I just quickly while you were talking was looking at my current stats. So right now, the current campaign's at 494 backers. Of those, 11 have come directly from Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. So, and Blue Sky. Yeah. Total of 11 that have been tracked from those links. Mm-hmm. So if you think about what makes sense in terms of putting your time, that's not to say I haven't been doing plenty of Facebook threads. Twitter is where I have my largest following and the most engaging one. And so, yeah, that makes sense that of those 11, 8 of those have come from Twitter. Mm-hmm. So all that time I spend there has gotten me 8 backers.
Right.
I think if you have a mailing list of people who have actually subscribed to you because they like you, that's very helpful versus like, I know there are people who advocate the big list builders and they get the mailing list of 40,000 or 30,000 and then they get like a 5% open rate.
Yeah.
Like I have a mailing list of roughly around 400 people. That's it. And those people open my stuff and they click through and they go. So I think a mailing list is important. When you have a bunch of campaigns, having a service like BackerKit Launch is great because then you can, you know, send out an email to everyone from your previous campaigns who's backed it. I will say with BackerKit Launch, all of the emails I'm getting from BackerKit Launch in Hotmail are now going to junk mail.
Yeah, wow.
Yes, I noticed that.
That is
so that's not good.
Yeah. Wait a minute. You still have a Hotmail account?
Yeah, my test emails went to my spam account, my junk account. Yeah.
Yeah. So my email that I use for Kickstarter is Hotmail. Yes. Not the one I give out to people who I actually like.
I have your Hotmail address.
I have Hotmail. Come on. Too. Yeah.
Damn it.
Well,
is it I have to ask.
This has got uncomfortable.
Don't dox yourself here, Charlie, but I have to ask, is it a funny name Hotmail address or is it a real name Hotmail address?
It's an abbreviation of my name, Hotmail address, which you might find funny. You probably particularly would find it funny.
Yeah.
You also gave me a 555 phone number and you never seem to pick up.
I'm very busy.
Sweet Chuck 69 at hotmail.com.
Sweet Chuck 69. Do you use something like MailChimp for a mailing list, or do you just do it the hard way?
Yeah, I have a I have a free MailChimp account because I haven't hit the threshold where I have to pay for it yet.
2000,
Like my people, I mean,
oh, is that it? It's MailChimp is free until it's 2000.
It's 2000, and then they go start paying. Yeah.
Interesting.
So for me, I've tried to build a fan base and a following that just likes what I do, so they're more receptive to actually getting emails and things from me. But I think backer updates, backer kit launch, email, for me, those are the most effective ways, and then blackmail.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I've never done a mailing list, and I may actually try to start one up because everybody speaks well of it as a technique. And I'm on mailing lists and I read those emails. I quietly unsubscribe from the ones that I'm not reading, the people I no longer want to hear from. But that is interesting advice. I mean, the other thing is about the whole social media of it all is that landscape is also changing every single day and every single time. And you sort of have to keep an eye on it and see if there's movement in any of those sectors.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's the thing about the change from Twitter to X was, you know, Charlie just gave us these kind of gross, you know, stat numbers from social media. And you used to be able to move traffic on Twitter, you know, and then Elon came in and almost overnight it was different. Yeah.
But it's not actually Elon. I'll tell you what it is. If there's a great TED talk, which is from the founder of Patreon, who talks about the evolution of the follower. And how that used to be the most important thing on social media. But then you had TikTok, which came along, which was an algorithm which was based on showing you what TikTok thought you should see, not based on what you were following. Mm-hmm. And it proved so successful. All the platforms started shifting over to algorithms based on what they think you should see versus who you're following. And so that's made a huge difference in terms of traction, in terms of being able to promote things.
Yeah, no, the important TED talk to get out to everyone is how to get a chronological timeline on every single social media site. Because there are ways on most of them, but they require some juggling to get to them. I feel like it slowed down, but there was a minute where every time I went on Twitter, it flipped me over to the For You tab from the Following tab. I think it has finally accepted my decision to stay on the Following tab forever and never look at For You. But what's fascinating to me is that I can tell without looking, I can usually tell in a couple of seconds. I'll get on Twitter and scroll for a second and go, I don't follow him. I don't follow him. I don't what? And then scroll back up and inevitably it's For You. Like it's so transparently, oh no, this isn't stuff I like. This is stuff X wants me to like or thinks that I like, you know, and the Facebook feed is now like 80% shit they think you're interested in and 20% your actual friends. I scrolled once. I should have video captured it, but I scrolled the Facebook feed once and didn't see anything that wasn't a page they wanted me to follow for like 30 posts before it got to an actual friend of mine. And that's, you know, literally the opposite of why any of us signed up for this stuff in the very, very beginning.
Yeah. The thing that I think we haven't touched on yet, you know, we talk about establishing, you know, establishing a presence, establishing a reason for people to back you, to care about, to stop at your table, all of these things. But it's really about establishing yourself in the community, right? It's like we've talked about this before. It's like comics is a team sport. We all win and, you know, or we all lose together. I think Kickstarter even more so. You know, I mean, the thing that I had going for me when I launched my first Kickstarter campaign was I was not some unknown commodity. It was like even if backers didn't know me, again, there was enough of a reason, you know, whatever, like, you know, Richard sort of made a joke, but, you know, Ringo Award winner, blah, blah, blah. It was like, there a reason for them to be like, oh, what's this? But what I had, my first go round was when I launched my campaign, there were 40, 50 well-known creators that had followings that people liked, that said, that retweeted, that posted, that tapped people on the shoulder and said, hey, check this out. Right. Mm-hmm. And every time I launch a campaign, I get that, you know, every time Steven, every time Charlie, every time Richard launches a campaign, they get that from me on day one. It was day two, for Charlie this time, because I was actually in the desert, and I have not apologized for that, but I'm sorry. First campaign of Charlie's, that I didn't back, probably an hour one, but anyway, but that is a big deal. You know what I'm saying? It is a big deal for any number of reasons. It's a big deal, you know, I mean, endorsement wise and hey, this is going on. I mean, it is powerful. I believe it is a responsibility also. Like, people do it for me. And so I feel like I have to, it is my duty, it is my responsibility to do it for them. I'm excited to do it for them. When Charlie drops another book, when Richard drops another book, I'm excited to read it. Not so much Steven, however, these other two guys. But you know, and it makes this huge difference. I mean, it makes a difference just from a visibility standpoint. It makes a difference in an algorithmic standpoint. You know, even if I go on, and if I am short on rent money that week, I can still go on, back Steven's campaign for a dollar, and it makes a difference. You know, the backer number goes up, yep. It juices up the algorithm. Kickstarter puts it in front of more at large backers.
Mm-hmm.
I would
just say that, like, just to go back to the social media thing of it all, like, David and I were talking about this last week, Ryland. I actually genuinely thought that you had left Twitter. Because, like, I follow you on Twitter. I use the following tab on Twitter to only see people I actually follow. And the same with David, who I knew is more on Blue Sky these days. So I just assumed both of you were gone, because literally the only time I see anything from you is when you retweet something of mine. And I always think, what a fucking great guy that he comes all the way onto the Twitter app just for me. And...
You know what? To a certain degree, I do, because I do not tweet a lot. I come to Twitter to signal boost my friends for the most part.
Look, I'm now doing a thing where I will try and think of a person who I haven't seen for a while on Twitter, look them up, go, oh shit, they're tweeting all the time, and just like 10 or 15 of their things, in the hope that the fucking algorithm will like say, okay, you want to see what Steven says.
Yeah.
No, I created a Twitter list called Don't Miss. Out of the people, that's mostly people that the algorithm was hiding from me. And I was like, I love their tweets and I never see them. So now I can flip over to this other tab and make sure I see these 30 people and don't miss the fact that this communications tool has to be treated like a mischievous 5-year-old that you're tricking into doing what you want it to do is absurd. You know, it's a, I remember the one-to-one of it all. The first time I realized the power of social media, I made a short film with James Urbaniak. And at the time he had maybe 25,000 followers, and it was very new Twitter times. It was like 2008 or 2009. And we made the short film, put it up on YouTube. He tweeted about it once, and I checked back the next day and it had 27,000 views. And I went, that seems like causation. That doesn't seem like correlation. That seems like all of his followers clicked a button and watched a movie on YouTube because he told them they should. And now they have so dynamited, undermined, fucked that up that we're all sort of trying to trick these things into doing their job. And that's, and that's a heavy lift. But as you say, like, you know, Charlie, you know, it is the thing where even when we know it's not working that well, we still like, well, I'm still going to post this on Facebook and hope it's best.
And that's, I mean, like, it was a little bit of an advertisement for Patreon.
Of course, I mean, that's,
it is worth listening to.
The most vested interest in the world is the Patreon guy telling you why other social media sites don't work very well.
But you know, he had a disclaimer, you know, like, he's like, look, I am the president of Patreon, I'm doing this. But it is something, if you're concerned about mobilizing your following, that I think it's well worth a watch. And, you know, and he talks about other ways beyond Patreon, which they are trying to build a little bit more of a social media app into it, going forward, to sort of create something what is follower based. But it's just really fascinating. And I think we as creators have to find ways to own our audience. And, you know, and this going, bringing it back to Kickstarter and bringing it back to whether Kickstarter is doing well or not doing well, you know, there's a chance that down the road, you know, like right now we're talking about Stripe. You know, we were briefly talking about at the beginning about how Stripe has come in and started creating some edicts for content and what's available in Kickstarter and what's not. And I, you know, I personally have a lot of problems with an outside company censoring content, right? That doesn't matter what the content is, just the concept of it. And what if they decide at some point in the future that they also don't want LGBTQ content or, you know, or whatever it is. Like, it's become such a slippery slope. And then does Kickstarter stay the viable platform for me? So I think there's a concept called digital sharecropping. I don't know if you've heard that before, but really that's what we're all doing with our social media sites. If we're on Twitter, if we're on Facebook or whatever, we don't own that platform. We are utilizing someone else's platform to build our following. So I think we as creators have to find ways to own our audience. So if it's Kickstarter, which for me right now is my primary revenue source and it works better than anything else, if that goes away, what's your fallback?
No, and that's good. And the thing, you know, we touched on it a little bit earlier, but I think if you view what's going on with Kickstarter without placing it in the context of, as Ryland said, the studio's literally not creating any new content and the movie studio's not understanding how distribution works anymore. To complain about the box office for Fall Guy and then offer it on HBO Max 2 weeks later is to grievously misunderstand how people are enjoying things these days. Even honestly, I think to call that movie, they assumed that the Fall Guy was a brand like G.I. Joe. Like Gargoyles. Spoiler alert, apparently it's not. If you had called that movie The Funny Stunt Man, it would have made a lot more money than calling it The Fall Guy. I literally think a non-Gen X contingent went, ew. You know, that is, what was that? Was that, what did, like, when you're trying to sell something as a franchise reboot of something nobody cared about in the first place?
Hey, I care.
And that's
gone and seen Fall Guy in the movie theater.
But but that's what they got wrong is so they assume it appeals to us, but it was like, my first thing is like, that's not the Fall Guy. The fuck are you talking about?
Lee Major.
I'm sitting here. I can step just off camera and grab my Fall Guy GMC truck from, you know,
you're not the kind to kiss and tell.
There you go. But I've been seen with Farrah.
They didn't manage to sell you a movie ticket, and they didn't manage to sell
because they took the name
and not the but even then it's kind of like so many of those things are things you grew up with. They're very much of a time and place, and they're not updated for today. You can't just take a concept from.
The first one that they did this with was Star Trek in 1979, and they used the original crew and all of that. That's pretty much, aside from maybe the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island, that may be the only time they used the original cast.
But it was new and fresh in 1979.
But also, people demanded it. There was a literal customer demand for it, which there are no Fall Guy conventions out there.
I disagree. Cosplaying, I think,
as the Fall Guy.
This movie could have done really well if they had had the theme song for the Fall Guy, if you had seen that truck, you know, like if you had seen a cameo from Lee Majors, I would bet all three of us would have been there to go.
See it would have been there day one.
If
it felt like they honored it.
It felt like a name only. That's why.
I will say this. I saw Fall Guy opening night. I saw it in a packed theater, and I had never heard of Fall Guy before. Yeah. I only knew it as the movie.
And you probably thought it was something totally different than what you got.
I got exactly what I went there for.
Okay,
good. You saw the trailer, you know.
Like, and like, I feel like the trailer had good saturation. I think the mistake they made, the other big mistake, is they called it, like, if it hadn't been connected to this other franchise, they wouldn't have had to call it Fall Guy, which sounds an awful lot like Free Guy, which no one liked. Maybe just move away from that. Maybe just say, hey, you like Ryan Gosling. He's kind of charming on screen. Come look at him do another thing. And everyone would have said, okay. Yeah,
there was absolutely no reason to connect it to...
That's the thing.
Another cheesy reboot. Yeah. What is this?
If you mind nostalgia, you need to honor it, or you need to have it be a send-up. Like, if you look at something like the Dukes of Hazzard movie, when that came out, I mean... Did some of us go see that? I saw that opening weekend. It had the General Lee in it.
Well, the better version of that is 21 Jump Street, where it was like,
Yeah. 21 Jump Street.
That was when they did that really well, what you're talking about.
The Brady Bunch.
The Brady Bunch movie, which, of course, grew out of a successful stage show that went around performing episodes of the Brady Bunch. But, yeah, it's a tricky thing, and you fall too easily into the Hollywood has no original ideas. Literally, if they'd called the movie a remake of Hooper, it would be the same movie. It wouldn't be, you know, you could have called it The Stunt Man. No one remembers brilliant Peter O'Toole movie.
But, you know, here's how this kind of really relates back to the comic Kickstarter thing, is that people get in their heads about what they think they should be doing on these platforms, or that there's some kind of code to be cracked. And that's when we start getting the... I think what's going to lead to a massive implosion, to talk about the state of the Kickstarter industry a little bit, as we start seeing more and more people running Kickstarters or selling products that are, here's how you kickstart, here's how you... I mean, more and more we're seeing things on not just how to run a campaign, but like what kind of... how to make your story more marketable.
I get two or three emails a week now.
The entire self-help field tends to boil down to a really solid way to make money is to bilk people with a self-help product. Yeah. Like, they all sort of boil down to the grift that I have grifted you out of money to learn how to make money. That's actually the money-making grift, is to sell people the idea of, I'll teach you how to make money.
But it's also like, well, what credits do you have? What Kickstarters have you run? Oh, no, we don't do that.
That is a classic, and it's not always true, but it's, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But a lot of times.
Maybe once a month, I get reached out to by PR firms I have never heard of for help with my career. And I generally go on Twitter, I look them up, and their Twitter platform has 300 followers.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, can you help me get up to 11,000 followers? Oh, wait, I have that. And you have 300, you know, like it's the, you know, I went on a date once with a life coach, and she lived in someone's garage. And I just remember thinking, when you have your first client meeting, you don't do it at home, right? Because that's I don't think she had a car either. And
where would she keep it if she did? The garage was full of her other furniture.
Yeah. She'd have to sleep in the car in the garage, right?
That the disconnect between, and like I said, I know some, you know, I know a great screenwriting teacher that has not actually written and sold a screenplay to the studios, and it's she really does know how to dot and teach.
Oh, there are people. Absolutely.
You know, she has a zillion produced students. that have come out of her classes, and that's great. So that doesn't always apply, but
no. What I mean is a lot of the stuff that I'm seeing marketing wise that I'm getting about Kickstarter, you know, there's been an explosion the past 6 months or so that I keep getting these marketing and they're, you know, like you look them up and they have, you know, whatever, 300 followers or they're whatever. That's all I mean. There has been a definite like rise. You're starting to see that, like Richard said, of people who are like, we'll get you to $20,000 in your campaign, you know, but writing a screenplay is very different from running an actual campaign. You know, you can teach structure and that, but
right. But like, you know, what we're seeing, like the things that are saying, we'll get you to this many followers or this many backers, we know they're playing on desperation.
Yeah.
What I think is like a shift in, you remember when there was that article about how there's going to be a vibe shift and we've all been holding our breath for it ever since. This makes me laugh about once a day. The shift we're seeing at the moment is people saying not how to do your campaign differently, it's how to produce your content differently. And I think that it's fundamentally damaging to the entire ecosystem of independent creation when you have people who are working outside of major publishers, who are working on things that they are passionate about, delivering exactly the product they want to deliver to you, stopping and rethinking and saying, but how could I make this more marketable? Right. How could I make this more in line with what already exists? Because that will lead to a collapse. People are not coming to Kickstarter for a superhero book that they could get for $4 at a store. They're coming to Kickstarter for things they cannot find anywhere else.
Right. Yeah. But you're already seeing it with the NSFW stuff where it's just slap some boobs on it.
I don't know.
You're seeing,
It's like Little Red Riding Hood, but with boobs. Oh, the twist is that she has a sword too.
But that's not someone who's doing a fairy tale book. I also think you're seeing 1,000 Little Red Riding Hood in outer space. Little Red Riding Hood.
Cthulhu. Exactly. Yeah, Cthulhu is a big thing. You know.
Yeah. And Cthulhu with boobs.
Yeah.
Cthulhu's. That's hard to say. It's not going to work.
Cthulhu boobs.
Cthulhu. Anyway, look.
Cthulhu boobs.
You don't want anyone calling your boobs the great old ones. That's
very good.
Better than the terrible old ones. I just think that we Rylan brought up the music industry before, and I think we all remember what 2010 sounded like. It was horribly overcompressed stuff done by people independently who had all started second-guessing themselves and trying to sound like whoever was popular at the time. And it did collapse. It did become terrible. And now I remember an age when we said, we'll never have anyone as popular as Britney Spears again. And now we're in an age of Beyonce and Taylor Swift. Like, the idea.
And ironically, they can sing.
I mean, I'm not here to be the leave Britney alone guy.
That's not a negative thing about her personality. I bring her up in terms of AI, in that everyone was afraid that auto-tune was going to create a pop star factory that was all hot young ladies who could dance a little bit and couldn't sing. And I don't know that the second Britney ever came along, like women who could actually hit high notes did not stop getting work. Christina Aguilera can actually sing. Beyonce can actually sing. And that's I wonder that with audit, like the will, and people kind of got hip to what autotune sounded like, and they sort of stopped listening to stuff that sounded like that.
Yeah. But this is also that same problem with the box office, where people know the word autotune and they hear a certain thing and they say it's autotune. What most people don't realize is that everything is auto-tuned to a certain degree. It's just about whether it's done well. It's the same. Like, we are now, I mean, Jesus fucking Christ, the like, let's talk about the weekend box office on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And so then people are like, oh, Furiosa's not doing well, I won't bother seeing it. And so then the Monday looks worse than it would have.
Yeah, like, no, it absolutely becomes that political thing of, I I don't want to go see a loser movie. I don't want to see the movie that's losing. And it's like, no, but you love the trailer. Go see the fucking movie.
Well, and let's bring this back to Kickstarter. I do think success begets success. So having that big first day or big enough first day on Kickstarter really does help you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this is where people new to Kickstarter are sometimes, you know, screwing up when they're launching, what days they're launching on. Like there were people who launched on Memorial Day and were complaining that they didn't have a lot of people showing up. Yeah. I almost always launch on a Monday, but I launched on a Tuesday. So I would launch the day after Memorial Day, but I just couldn't believe the complaints. And they're like, it must be Twitter. It must be Kickstarter is down. I'm like, no, it's user error. And so much of this is user error.
Yeah, I love when I get a launch notification at like 8 p.m. at night.
Yeah.
I mean, like, what are you doing?
You know, I've gone on podcasts and they drop the episode at 10 p.m. on Sunday.
Yeah.
East Coast, 10 p.m. on Sunday. I'm like, well, that's going to be great for your listeners in Hawaii. That is fantastic. Everyone else is never going to know this happened.
Yeah.
I've seen PR, you know, I won't name names, but I've done events and comics for companies that like the press release goes out Saturday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm like, no one, this is now at the bottom of a pile of emails someone's going to read on Monday morning. And you will be so lucky if they notice it.
Yeah.
That seems really elemental to me, but like, you know,
there was a publisher that I knew from somewhere once that in the middle of Comic-Con put out a release about one of their books that was going to be coming out in 7 months from now. And they decided that the middle of San Diego Comic-Con was the time to drop this news about this book that may or may not ever come out. I'm just saying, timing matters.
Yeah. And, you know, you can definitely talk about a book that's 7 months away at Comic-Con at a panel, you know, in front of an audience that's there to hear about your publisher or your writer or your artist or whatever. You know, talk about it at your booth, have a poster.
Yeah, they were not Comic-Con. They just thought it was a good idea to drop their news in the middle of all the big releases from much larger publishers that were happening at the same time, where they had the people there on panels to sort of support it. Anyway, I do think like so much of this comes down to user error. And when you say, you know, people are not doing well on Kickstarter, like if you look at the top 6 to 10 projects right now, almost all of them are things that you've heard of before or creators that you've heard of before.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, and that's, these people are doing well. If you think about the people who are usually the most vocal about struggling, about social media not helping them, they either just don't have a book that's good enough. And I'm sorry, I'm just going to say that the books aren't good. The art isn't good enough. They haven't done a good job of building a following. They've alienated their following for various reasons. Or Kickstarter has just gotten better. And so you can't rest on your laurels. I'm not doing the same things that I did 6 years ago on Kickstarter to try to get an audience. I'm not putting out the same kind of project page. Things have evolved. You need to evolve over time. You can't expect the same results of things that you did 4 years ago to work as well now.
Yeah. And a lot of the complaint is social media, but to the point Charlie and Rylan brought up, and I think Charlie was the one who told me this a few years back about Kickstarter being an ecosystem. The biggest boosts that I get are cross promotions. When Charlie mentions Monster Matador in his campaign updates, I get a boost, right? When I mention Charlie, I think he loses backers, but that's, you know. But, you know, when someone else tweets about my campaign, it's more beneficial because, again, it's word of mouth, you know. When I say monster, you know, it's a lot of it too. Like for me, I do a book that's a kaiju book. Kaiju books are really big right now. And I've reached out to that audience. Like I find kaiju fan groups, you know. It's a niche, but these guys go to bat for me. They're on Twitter literally every day promoting me. And that's where my audience is coming from. So like you really need to, it's not just like, hey, I've got a book on Kickstarter, come to me. You have to find your people, you know, you got to find your tribe. So, and a lot of that is it's cross promoting. It's, you know, reaching, you know, we have Facebook groups with creators that reach out, you know, we help each other out. And a lot of it is, it's not, a lot of us don't view it as a competition. Ryland and I have launched books at the same time. Ryland is always going to do bigger numbers than I am. It's not a competition between us. You know what I mean? Yeah. And, you know, you have to figure out a way to work with others and to accept that, yeah, some campaigns are going to do better, but you need to focus on what your campaign is going to do and how it's going to do that.
Yeah,
you said many times to me, it's just not a competition between me and Steve.
Yeah.
But
I see people say, like, have that attitude that I don't want to promote someone else's campaign because that's going to take away a backer for me. If someone's going to back Ryland's campaign and they don't have money for mine, that's fine. I don't, you know what I mean? That's fine. You know what I mean?
It is a team sport. You know, again, like you find your people, and the reason that I have a great launch day is because I know that there are going to be 30, 50 creators who show up minute one, just immediately. You know what I'm saying? It was again, I always do that for Charlie. I didn't do that this time because I was in the desert.
And his numbers dropped.
I felt bad about it. But same thing with Charlie. And Charlie doesn't necessarily need mine anymore because he has 400 other people that will show up on day one. However, that is a big deal. And the reason that I have 30 to 50 creators who will show up for me every single first day is because when they launch a campaign, I'm their first day. I am their hour one if I can. I'm tweeting about it. I'm doing all that stuff. And if you do that, then people are going to do that for you. And it always burns me, but it confuses me when I run into somebody who doesn't get that, who can't do it, you know, who I see, you know, me, four other creators I'm close with, like, we have backed that person. We have supported that person. We have promoted that person day one, hour one, four or five campaigns. And then one of us launches and they're MIA and grouchy and all of these other things. And that's weird. And I just take note. And I'm not this vindictive asshole or whatever, but it's like, well, you know, but sometimes not completely. However, like when, you know, there's a lot on the platform. And if I do have to make a choice, I'm going to be there for the people that are there for me. I'm going to be there for Charlie. I'm going to be there for Richard. I'm going to be there for Steven. And if I can only back three campaigns, then that person who's not a productive part of the ecosystem is going to be out, and it's their fault.
Well, there's another part of the fan perspective of the industry that I think I've never heard anyone take note of, but I think it's significant. People who are not in show business like to believe that everyone in show business is friends and hangs out. Like there's a chumminess to it that is actually part of the equation, that is part of how the fans used to imagine that Marvel was all of those guys sitting in a room together, drawing and laughing and having a good time. Wasn't true at all. You know, half of them hated Stan Lee, half of them loved him. You know, it was, but the mythos was the happy gang of idiots, and we're all having a good time and we're all buddies and all that. People want to believe that movie stars have dinner together and are all buddies and aren't faking it for the cameras. So there's that aspect of when you're bantering with your colleagues on social media, when you're kicking shit around on social media, when they see you doing this at cons, there's this idea of you're all part of this bigger thing that they love. And they kind of love to see you like each other.
Yeah.
I know that may sound strange, but I know the part of the parasocial relationship is, there's Avalone talking to Stickney again. They like each other. Like, I like his books. I should read his, like, it, there's just a part of the idea of, you know, like Ryland, I'm a big promoter of the idea that it's a community for all of the good reasons for all of us. But I do think that when the fans view it as a community, there's just something that seems warm and fuzzy to them about that. And they note when it's missing also.
It's also that, like, especially with writers, or writer artists, but I think, you know, more so with, like, I guess what I'm saying is not so much with just artists, but there's a sense that you are inherently in the book you're creating. And if people like you, mm-hmm. and then they will like the people you like. You know, Charlie and I table together once a year because that's about all he can stand of me. But like we do incredibly different types of books. And I don't think that there's a world where anyone out in the wild would find like Glarian and someone would say, if you like Glarian, you should check out Haunted Hill. Like that's not going to happen. But if someone's talking to Charlie at the table and they like Charlie and they like his vibe, and then they're like, they look at me like, well, Charlie will put up with this guy. I wonder what his stuff is like. And yeah, I do think we actually have a huge crossover in audience is the funny part to it. But like, it really is about that, who is vouching for you. Yeah. And then you have these people who, like, I do very well through conventions, far better than I do on Kickstarter, annoyingly, because I can do Kickstarter from home. But like, I was at a show last year, and there was an absolute just black hole of a person next to me. And someone came over, and another person who was doing poorly at this convention came over, and they're like, oh, you're so lucky you're next to someone. Like, you're next to someone like that. And I was like, why? And they're like, because it means that you get all the attention. I'm like, no, it means I have to work twice as hard because everyone wants to run away from this like sad sack of crap that I'm stuck with.
Look, I had a bad weekend. You have been on me about it ever since then. You know, just let's drop it. That is like, not,
I
mean, cool. Look,
I have been very clear, sitting is quitting.
No, but the idea of, especially as a writer, you are absolutely the brand that you're selling, and your voice is what you're selling. And I will 100% cop to this. Knowing what a big platform Elvira was going to give me, and the fact that she breaks the fourth wall, I think as early as issue 2 of Elvira, I had her calling me out by name and saying, oh, Avalone wants me to do recaps, but stick that on the front inside front cover. I don't do that. That's boring. Elvira doesn't do exposition. And I have had her call me out by name about every 3 or 4 issues. And I am absolutely doing that. The same reason for Stan Sopos. I want the people who read Elvira, whether they looked at the front cover or the inside front cover or not, they know David Avalone writes the book and seemingly has a parasocial relationship or social relationship with their favorite character. And that is that was absolutely done by me on purpose to make myself more famous, to make my name. Like, if I'm going to do this Elvira book, I am boosting myself, and I appear as a character in several issues of the thing, as David Avalone. There's a character based on me, but there's also me, who she occasionally complains to about what direction the book is taking or whatever. And that's not that's not an accident. I can't put my picture on the cover of the book, but I can absolutely have someone draw me into the book and they go, oh, that's, I saw that guy at WonderCon, you know, and that's just one. And part of this comes from the fact that I noticed back when I was a filmmaker that since the 1930s, since Frank Capra came up with the possessory credit, a Frank Capra film, even though someone else wrote it, even though someone else, you know, other actor, everyone else was acting in it. The Hitchcock thing. If you want to be successful, you're the story.
Yeah.
Not you. You're bigger than Jimmy Stewart. In fact, it's an.
You have to glue.
Starring Gary Cooper.
Yeah. You have to glue your mustache on every day now, though, people recognize you.
Joke though it may be, like
it is. It's
I don't shave it off.
Yeah.
I have a appearance coming up.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's become your brand. It's become your brand. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't look like the avatars on social media. Then I'm not taking advantage of it. Yeah. You know, and there is definitely a turning point in the idea of fame where, you know, I think Neil Gaiman said once, I have the perfect amount of fame. No one recognizes me walking down the street except the one in 10,000 people. Actually looks at the pictures of the writers of comic books.
But I don't know if he still does, but for years it was always a black leather jacket and the black sunglasses. For the 90s anyway, that was his, like, you know, look, kind we of the same thing. Yeah.
We were all doing that in the 90s. Yeah.
But it, we, no, it's like, you know, like you say, it's the brand, you know, Stan Lee with the glasses and the mustache. I mean, it's the brand. But you look at Stan Lee pictures from the 50s, he's unrecognizable. He's yeah. just a bald dude. You know, he's just an average.
Yeah, before the rug and before bald the dude. Mustache.
Yes. Like, yes.
If you saw me at a if you saw me at a con without a bottle of Jack Daniels, you would not recognize that's the bottom line. Yep.
Well, on that note, on branding, we should wrap this thing up. But everyone, tell us. We'll start with Charlie. What is the current campaign, and where can people find it?
How I Slept My Way Through College and Other Tales from Freshman Year. You can pick up the first three issues. It's on Kickstarter. Quickest way to get there is from a link in my bio on Twitter, or I guess on Facebook or on Instagram under White Ash Comics.
Awesome. Richard?
I'm Richard Fairgray, the current owner of horsegoogle.org. my Kickstarter is for The Exercise of Frankenstein 1-3. And I talked about that before. So more importantly, if you want to find horses near you, go to horsegoogle.org. And once you realize how dumb that joke is that I'm for some reason going for, go to kickrichard.com, which will take you to my current campaign and will always take you to whatever my current campaign is.
That is such a brilliant idea, having that really simple URL. And I have to say, obviously, I haven't read Charlie's book yet, but I have read The Ex-Wives of Frankenstein, issues 1 and 2, and it's just a fantastic book. Yeah. And I am also a large fan of the Monster Matador. Steven, what's going on with your hero today?
So we're on Kickstarter, Monster Matador, Once Upon Some Monsters in Mexico. We're on the third issue. You can find us the link in my thing here, bit.ly, and case sensitive OUSMIM03. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram all have the link. You could go to monstermatador.com, though I think I need to put the link in there. Or just check out Ryland's Twitter feed or whoever's retweeting me. You know, it's Monster Matador all the time.
And that Twitter feed is at Ryland Grant. I am at Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. That is R-Y-L-E-N-D-G-R-A-N-T. If you were just listening, I have to spell it because it's not a real name. My parents drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it. And so now I have to spell it for you. We brought these creators on for a reason. Great people. Great writers and artists, and these are great books. They are all their campaigns are first day backs for me. I backed Charlie's on the second day because I was out in the desert. I apologize again. However, so you should drop everything and run to Kickstarter right now and back these campaigns. Great books. I will be joining them on Kickstarter soon. I don't know with what just yet, but I'm coming. I'm coming in hot. I don't know. Come visit me on the first day. How about that? Bring us on home, Avalone.
Yes, thanks everyone for joining us. And yes, you should back all these things. The thing I always like to say about Kickstarter is, for me, it's like having a magic box, a mystery box subscription, because I forget. I mean, it's, you know, Steven, Richard, Charlie, I know very well, and I will remember that I have backed them. But I get an envelope probably every 3 weeks and go, what the hell is this? And I don't recognize this return address. And I open it and there's a comic book inside that I've completely forgotten that I backed, and I read it, and sometimes it's really great. And that, and I discover someone new, or I discover, you know, something that I want to follow. Richard, Charlie, and Steven are very, very, very reliable creators on the platform and in comics in general. And you will not be disappointed. I have secondhand embarrassment if I ever am encouraged to recommend something that I don't like, because I feel like that will follow me around forever. So when I say read these comics, I read these comics. It's not gratuitous. I would not have had them on the show if I was embarrassed to recommend the comics. They're all really great and very different. And as far as myself, like I said, I've got stuff in comic book stores. There are still a few of those out there. Elvira meets H.P. Lovecraft on its final issue. the third volume of Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, just randomly dropped out of nowhere. And that's a fun little self-contained story. And Drawing Blood, my passion project of the last years, co-created with Kevin Eastman, about a comic book creator who creates something and it overwhelms his life, which will appear vaguely familiar to some people. That was begun as two Kickstarters, and now will be 12 issues coming from Image for the next 10 months. So please check that out. Thank you for watching and or listening, and we'll catch you on the next exciting episode.
Thanks, guys. I was in the desert, okay?
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more Madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.